Hi, good evening and welcome to this first of these series of evenings here in Costa under the title Meet Jesus. My name's Tim Davis and I'm the minister at Christchurch Central and we're the ones who are hosting and welcoming you to these evenings. I just want to give you a little bit a signpost, really, of what we're going to be doing. In a moment, I shall introduce our speaker, and he'll have 10 minutes or so on his given subject and topic. And then we'll have a chance to chat around our tables. And on the tables, you'll find some pieces of paper and some pens. And you can write down your questions, and I'll come round and pick them up. And then our speaker will be joined by two others on a panel here, and we'll have a time of open questions. And you can ask any question. And the first time they will have heard it or seen it is when I ask them. So it'll be fun and interesting, but I hope a fair and honest opportunity to just talk about very, very important things. It's great to come into a place like this, have a really good coffee, sit in the company of great friends, and to be able to talk together about some of the most important issues that there are, really, for us to be engaging with and to be thinking about. So with that in mind, let me introduce tonight's speaker. This is Andy. And just three significant things about Andy. Andy's got six children, so a big round of applause for him for that. He's wearing Very Focals for the first time. And perhaps most famously of all, he's had beans on toast at Buckingham Palace with Andrew, but not the Andrew, some other bloke called Andrew. So Andy, thanks ever so much for being willing to just give us 10 minutes. The question we've given you is, who is Jesus? So Andy, over to you, thanks. And then I'll come back and talk about a Q&A in a moment.
Thank you. Thanks for your kind round of applause for my six children. You can buy me a drink later for that. I've got 10 minutes to talk about the most significant question that you've been asked today, probably this week, and I think probably the most significant question you'll ever be asked, and that is, who is Jesus? I did a search on Amazon. I don't know why I chose Amazon, but it was enlightening. There are 279,000 books on Jesus. There are 18,000 DVDs. There are 10,500 CDs, and there are, and this was the worrying one, 3,700 toys when you type in Jesus all departments. There's a Jesus dressing up costume, you'd expect that one. The Jesus action figure, you've probably seen that. My mouse did hover momentarily over that one, but I resisted. There's an inflatable Jesus. There's a grow your own Jesus. And I'm going to stop there because it got a bit ridiculous. 3,700 of them. If you Google Jesus, you'll get, I need a mathematician, 515 million sites that mention Jesus. So, a big question, who is Jesus? And there's a lot of people out there who feel that they've got something to say about Jesus. Over the years, he's been called a peasant revolutionary, an intellectual spouting pithy, clever sayings, a Mediterranean cynic, a proto-hippie, an androgynous feminist, a clever messianic pretender, and even a gay magician. So who was he? Who was Jesus? And was he, as the Gospels, the four accounts of the life of Jesus that we have in the Bible, was he, as the Gospels so clearly tell us, the Messiah, the Son of God? Well, over the next 3 nights at Costa, you've got the card in front of you. Please use this and invite friends and family and neighbours. If there's somebody you don't like on your street, invite them. Anybody, strangers, people you know, invite them, because we've got these three questions. Who was Jesus? Why did he come to earth? And the third one is, what does Jesus demand of us? And they are really significant questions. And we want to get a glimpse over these next 3 nights. A glimpse of the real Jesus, the actual Jesus. So we're looking at Mark's Gospel. Now you've got these on your table, and we encourage you to take them. They're free. Please take them, and they're yours. There's loads of them. We've got a box full, I guess, somewhere. If there's not enough on your table, they're there for the taking. And this is where we're going to be looking to try and find answers to these three big questions. And we're looking at Mark's Gospel because this account from the very earliest days was accepted to be historically accurate, historically true in what it revealed about Jesus, who he was and his purpose on earth. So it's a great place for us to turn. It's the perfect place for us to turn to find answers in our quest to discover more about Jesus. We'll find reliable answers, answers based on eyewitness testimony, people who saw and heard Jesus himself. And they were the best placed people to debunk any nonsense that was in there in the beginning, right from the start. And yet it still stands now as a reliable historical document. Please take that. This is where we're getting our ideas from. We urge you to take a copy home and read it for yourself. It's an interesting question. Who is Jesus? People like to share their views. I guess you're no different. I quite like occasionally doing public surveys. I'll go around and ask people with a bit of paper and a clipboard, asking people questions about faith, about their ideas. And everyone is happy, generally speaking, to answer their question and share their thoughts on who they think Jesus is. And Jesus does exactly that, because in Mark chapter 8, which is where we're... Now, a little apology for these. Even with my very focals on, the text is very small. I'm struggling even with my new glasses. But in chapter 8, halfway through Mark's Gospel, he tells us this little account when Jesus is with his friends, his disciples. They're walking through a city called Caesarea. And he does this public, this little survey, this little... poll on what people think about him. And he asked this question: who do people say that I am? Now, most people in our society today have a kind of respect for Jesus. They want to give him generally the plaudit of he was a good man, he was a good example, he was a moral teacher. And the answer that Jesus gets back is actually quite similar to that. The answer he gets back from his disciples is some people saying that you're Elijah or one of the prophets. It's an interesting answer. People generally in Jesus' time thought he was one of the greatest prophets. A national hero, this man Elijah. I won't go into all the detail about Elijah. You can read for him about him yourself in the Old Testament. Long story. But a bit of a national hero. What a great thing to be known as. And they thought they were giving him a great compliment as they said this. But as the people of Jesus' day were trying to sort of compliment Jesus in this kind of roundabout way, they had got it wrong. They'd actually made a huge error. It was oh so wrong. It was not enough. Their praise of him fell far short. I had an incident a few years ago when I was introduced to somebody. I kind of had met her before. I didn't really know much about her. I knew she worked in a hospital. I thought, and this is kind of just reveals my fantastic ability to prejudge situations and to prejudge people, sadly. I thought she was a nursing auxiliary, which is, you know, people who clean up the sick and all the messy stuff in hospitals. And as we were chatting, she said, "I've got to go soon because my shift starts at the hospital." And I said, "Oh, so are you a nurse?" And what I was doing there was kind of upping her kind of rank from auxiliary nurse to nurse. I thought, give her a bit of a compliment, she'd like that. She said, "Now I'm a consultant, actually." Well, it kind of just hit me, you know, how prejudiced I was, but also how wrong you can be just judging by appearance. These people think they're complimenting Jesus. Jesus says it's not enough. And he turns to Peter, his friend, and Jesus asks the next question. "Peter, who do you say that I am? Who do you say I am?" Here's H.G. Wells. H.G. Wells said, "I'm a historian. I'm not a believer, but I must confess as a historian that this penniless preacher from Nazareth is irrevocably the very center of history." Well, I'm sorry, H.G. That's very nice, but it's not enough. It's really not. It all sounds very complimentary, but it's not praise enough. "Who do you say I am?" asks Jesus. And Mark, as he writes this gospel account of the life of Jesus, is feeding us all the clues that he can so that we get it right and so that we give Jesus the appropriate place in our thinking and in our lives. I want to say it's not just an interesting question on a general level, who do you say that I am? But it's really an important question. In fact, I'd say it is the important question. It's important because it has a bearing on all of your life and indeed what happens beyond death as well. You may have heard of John Newton, the guy who wrote the famous hymn Amazing Grace. He wrote another song, poem song, and he wrote this. He said, "What you think of Christ is the test to try both your state and your scheme. You cannot be right in the rest unless you think rightly of him." He had it right. Because if we're wrong on the identity of Jesus, we're not just misunderstanding some factual information. We've missed out on something way more significant. If you're here tonight at Costa looking at Christianity from the outside, you're very, very welcome. Or indeed, you may be looking at it from the inside with some developing doubts and uncertainty. Well, to all of us, this is the one question to grapple with. This is the question to wrestle with. Don't let go of this question. Who do you think I am? Don't let go of this question until you come to a clear mind on it. It's the important question, really. And Jesus asks it because he wants you to find the answer. Because in finding the answer, Jesus says you will find life. You'll find eternal life. Well, that's enough about the question. What about the answer to this interesting and important question? Who do you say that I am? What's the answer? Well, up until now, Jesus' friends, the disciples, as Mark has written about them, they've only ever called Jesus teacher. That's been their kind of title for him. But now the moment of revelation comes, and it is by God's help that Peter gives the answer. So it is literally revelation. Peter He steps forward from his group of friends, and as the representative of these men, he gives the answer. And finally we get the right answer, and it's really simple. Mark writes, Peter answered, "You are the Christ." Every word of his confession is important. You are the Christ. You, not anyone else, but specifically and exclusively you, Jesus. You are, not might be, not could be, not maybe one day will become, but you are the Christ. The, not one among many, but the only. And Christ, which is not a surname, as maybe sometimes we're mistaken to believe. Not a surname, but a title. The Christ, a title, meaning God's promised ruler and king. The king of the universe. Now, earlier, Mark, in the very beginning of his book, had let the cat out of the bag in the very opening sentence of his account of the life of Jesus, because he begins by saying, the beginning of the good news about Jesus the Christ, the Son of God. So now, 8 chapters later, Peter catches up on the plot. And he shows that he gets who Jesus really is. Not just his friend, not just a great teacher or even a prophet, but Jesus really is the rightful owner of the universe. Christ, or Messiah, as it's just another word for it. Same word. That's what all the Bible, the scriptures that Peter was brought up on, that's what all the Bible declares the Christ to be. The one who is the proprietor of the whole world. The king. God's promised king. Peter's king. Your king. And at this point in his account, Mark is wanting us, the reader, to share this conclusion. He wants us to be persuaded too that Jesus is this king who has every right to demand of us what he's going to demand on Thursday night, just a few verses later from what we've just looked at, when my friend Dan will be asking the question, what does Jesus demand of us? And I'll steal his thunder now, because he won't mind, he's not here. What is it that Jesus demands of us? If he's the king, he demands that we follow him. He demands that we entrust our lives to him, that we treat him as the king that he is, that we submit and follow him. My final question is this: why should we be prepared to have our whole lives turned upside down for this carpenter from Nazareth? Why should we believe this? Why? Well, because in the first 8 chapters, before we get to this incident where Jesus asks the question, who do you say that I am? The first 8 chapters, Mark has been giving us evidence. Compelling evidence, historical evidence, persuasive evidence that Jesus really is the king. And that's why I'm finishing right here and right now. And I'm leaving you with the challenge. I dare you. I very dare you to take this and to read those 8 chapters. It's not difficult. Get some strong glasses. It's a little bit small. It's in modern English. And read the evidence. Get a mug of tea. Get a highlighter pen. Find a quiet nook. And just, for yourself, read the evidence as to why Jesus should be considered as and should be followed as the king. The one who has every right to call you to follow him. The one who has every right to demand that you rearrange your life around his priorities and not your own. The one who has every right to be your king. That's me done. I'll hand back to Tim. Cheers, Tim.
Andy, thank you very much indeed for what you had to say there. We've got a chance to ask some questions. Like I said earlier on, pieces of paper, pens on the tables. Write down a couple of questions. Andy's just been talking about Dan, and Dan has just arrived. We've just been talking about you, Dan, behind your back, and here you are. So good to welcome you. Questions, write them down, and I'll come round and pick them up in just a moment and introduce you to the others on the panel. So a few moments to talk and write. Can you hear me okay? Yep. We've got quite a few questions here, and time's moved on somewhat, so you have to bear with me as I rattle through them and rustle through them really quite quickly. But I want to introduce you to David and to Wadu. Wadu, first of all, Wadu is a maths lecturer at Sheffield Hallam. She's also a poet, and she loves music, and she doesn't understand why other people go down to the gym. That's David. I asked David's daughter, Grace, here about him, and apparently he loves orange. He tells very, very funny jokes that are funny to him. He wears interesting cufflinks, like the ones he's wearing tonight are E-type Jaguar ones. So there we go. So that's Dave Wadu and Andy I've already introduced you to. Let me start off with just two or three simple and straightforward they might be straightforward questions. If Jesus offers us so many good things, why doesn't everyone want to follow him? What stops them? I'm going to come to you, Andy, for that. What stops people following Jesus if he does offer so many good things?
Great question. I think Christ is incredibly appealing. The more you realize who he is, as in the king, the owner of all things, the owner of you, the more then you realize actually to know him, to follow him, not only brings fantastic things, eternal life, forgiveness, God's love, and a host of other things, but it actually demands from us that we, as I said earlier, rearrange our lives, and our priorities must then become his priorities, not our own. So it demands change, which is not attractive. We like to be boss of our own world, our own decisions, our own choices. To follow Christ means that he is the boss, not us, and that's not attractive. On the surface, when you realize that actually it does lead to blessing, to be ruled by Christ leads to great things, we need his help to see how great it is.
Andy, thank you very much indeed. I guess that part of that is we have a strange, in our culture, strange understanding of authority and what it means to have a king over us. And to the King Jesus of the Bible is rather different. Wadi, let me ask you this question. Why did Jesus come such a long time ago and not now? I don't expect you to know the answer to that, by the way. What are your thoughts, though? I mean, yeah, he came at a particular point in history.
Yeah. I can't say particularly why. What I think what the Bible says is he was promised from a long time ago, and he came to fulfill those promises. But I don't think I can say why that particular time. One thing that is interesting is if you look at the timing of the early church and when they took the message about Jesus, so after Jesus died and rose again, it was quite a unique point in history in terms of the transportation systems that were coming to place and all that sort of fed into the spreading of the message. So who knows? I don't know.
That's some good insight. So thank you, Wally, very much. David, if Jesus owns the universe, why can't we see him?
That's a great question as well. Mm. I would say, are you sure you don't? I think it's critical to realise the questions you ask, are they honest questions? And do you honestly have a conscience? And if you honestly have a conscience, does that conscience ever say to you, there just might be a God? And if he's God, is he your God? So you may not see with your eyes, but you might see with your heart just enough to get started. So to say, I don't see, are you prepared to say that to God, I never knew? Because he only asked you to take the first step.
Can I ask you a follow-on question, David, keeping with you, because I think this next one goes with the flow of what were some of the things you've just been saying. Why do normal, trustworthy and intelligent people not believe Jesus was the Christ? Why should I believe his claims?
I grew up in a household with an atheist, and I knew with a rock-solid certainty that the answers had nothing to do with Christianity. And I just lost faith with it. I couldn't hold it. Because it asks for everything and delivers nothing. That's my own personal story. It lacked conviction, it lacked attraction, and it took me nowhere. And on the contra side, and the Christians are asked to produce evidence, produce evidence, produce evidence. You've got history that speaks loud and clear. Now, you can reject it out of hand, and that's the fashionable thing to do, to say because people don't rise from the dead, because miracles do not happen, because there's no proof of eternity, every bit of evidence has to be rejected out of hand. I became convinced that lacked all integrity. And I couldn't follow down that way. So I had to say to my dear dad at some point, I've become a Christian. And he was devastated. And I don't think he's quite recovered yet, but my teenage rebellion was to become a Christian and start studying at school and to realize it's really important to respect your parents. And, you know, so I would say intelligent people don't believe. And I wouldn't say because you're clever and you do believe it makes it right. It's right because it's right.
Okay. Just following on, Awadu, I'll ask you this question because you are smart. You've got a PhD in mathematics. David's smart too as well. I'm not saying, Andy,
smart.
You're not. David's a consultant at the Children's Hospital. And there are smart people who don't believe. But this question is from somebody who sees that actually it is just smart people who perhaps believe and those that perhaps aren't so smart don't. So how do we know that Jesus died for all of us and not just those who are richer or smarter, etc., than us? Interesting, isn't it? The two very different kind of questions there.
Well, I think as the church, we have to look at ourselves sometimes and see if we have blinders that make us sort of present the gospel in a certain way that makes it seem more exclusive than it is. If you look in history, you'll see it in one of the books in the Bible where one of the leaders had to write a letter to say, you can't do this. Poor people come into the church and you push them to the side. So we all have to take an honest look at ourselves and say, you know, do we see human beings and do we value all human beings in that, in the way that Jesus values them? The other thing is to look at Jesus' life and to see who he called, as his disciples to follow him. He called fishermen and he called a rich tax collector. He called a political zealot. You know, he called a variety of people. He had women travel along with him, which was very unusual at the time, and he touched lepers. You know, so that's how you know that Jesus is for everyone, because his life speaks loud and clear. His life spoke loud and clear. And when you look at Jesus, it's clear. Maybe sometimes his followers don't always get it right, but if we go back and look at him, then we will adjust to be more like him.
Thank you. I want all three of you to answer this question. Just give us a brief two or three points in your answer. We'll start with you, Andy. You kind of picked it up already. How can we trust Mark's gospel? Lots of fictional works contain some genuine historical details. Surely that doesn't have to mean it's all true. And a similar question related to that. How do we know that the Bible is more valid than other religious texts? So they're kind of associated, related questions. But, you know, going down the line there, something from each of you on why you trust Mark's gospel, why you trust the Bible more than other religious literature.
I'm going to go with it's not a cop-out, you know, but it is the experiential kind of aspect of the answer, which we can easily run away from and just treat it as an academic, intellectual issue. We've got to read it. We've got to give it time. And I think the attitude in which we read it, with a humility, asking God, if he's there, you may be unsure that he's even there. God, if you are there, then I want Jesus to walk off the pages of this book into my life. I want to meet Jesus in the Gospel of Mark. Pray that and read it for yourself. And then, I'm not saying it's not a valid question, but then perhaps we can look at some other answers to the question of should we trust Mark? Read it in an honest and humble way and see what you think then.
Thanks, Andy. What do you?
That's part of it.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was going to say.
You can give the clever answer.
No, I think, yes, it's about meeting a person. And I think I think if you read the book of Mark or any of the accounts of Jesus, there's never been anyone like him. And I think you'll notice it if you read it. And you have to ask God's help, because it's about getting to know a person, the ultimate being. So how are you going to know someone if that person doesn't help you out? So it's not a cop-out, really. It's the way to know God.
Thank you. David.
There's a copy of John's Gospel in the British Library dating back to AD 120, so it's within 80 years of the crucifixion. There's a copy. And the person who recorded it probably knew the apostle. That's pretty powerful when it comes to historical evidence. That even if the one book you've got is just John's Gospel, it's within a living memory of the crucifixion. There isn't another religious text that has that veracity to it. The ancient copies of the New Testament have been found in St. Petersburg, have been found in St. Honorat off the coast of Nice, and these are going back to early 2nd century. And they're consistent and they're accurate and they're not mutated. So there's an awful lot to say, if you want to just be a historian, you've got to trust the reliability of the texts. And I think cleverer people than me have come up with that conclusion. And I've had to say, for me at the moment, that was enough. But it's important that it's, again, true because it's true, not because we want it to be true.
Thank you. You'll have to excuse me. I'm not going to ask all the questions. Time has moved on. There are three questions here which are reasonably personal by nature. I'm going to ask you not to answer all three, but I'll ask you one each just see where we go with this. I suppose this is a personal question. It's kind of personal relating to God. And I think, David, I'll ask you this one. Does it really matter what I think? How can my opinion be of significance to God? Is God really that needy? You know, that's kind of like God, personal to God, really. Is he that
needy?
Can
I just declare I wrote that question?
So, sorry, go on.
So can I just declare, I did write that question.
Did
so.
You really?
Yeah, so if you would.
What did you want to ask that question?
He'll tell you the answer.
Notice the integrity and the honesty of the man. I think you'd come up with a brilliant answer. We'll see if you got an answer to your own question in a moment. What did you want to answer David's question? Good on you, David.
I think... So God created the world, and he has a vision for the world that he created, and he has a vision for what's good. He knows what's good for the world. And so how we relate to God is not just, it doesn't just affect us individually. It affects everything. But also, it's important to say that God doesn't need our worship because he didn't create us out of need. He created us out of generosity and love because he has so much to give. So it's not that he needs it, but it's that he deserves it. And I suppose what I'm trying to say is the earth cannot carry on in this way. if we carry on... not being rightly related to God, then it has a ripple effect on everything. And God has said that he's going to come back and sort out everything eventually. And that's part of sorting out everything. So.
Thank you, Waddy. A question for you, Andy. How can we fit a Jesus from 2,000 years ago into the modern world? How do we fit Jesus into life, my life now?
Good question. The Jesus of 2,000 years ago is not physically with us, but he is by his spirit with us. He's alive in us as his followers, and. Life is to be lived in all its variety, in all its difficulty, which is the same wherever you are and whatever century you live in. Christ enables people to meet the challenges of life and the joys of life in a way that pleases him, in a way that we were meant to enjoy, that relationships and work, illness, good health, all that life throws at us. He knows it. He's experienced it himself as a man, as he lived on earth, and now he gives us that ability to face it and the hope as well that not everything is as it should be, but it will be one day. He will return.
Andy, thank you. Final question for you, David. I carry a lot of guilt. Will I be good enough for Jesus?
Maybe that person is the closest to God's heart. You do carry a lot of guilt. I carry a lot of guilt. And if you don't, then you have no business with Christ. That Christianity is really for people who've done harm. You know, really hurt other people. Really let other people down. And if you haven't, you're not actually honest with yourself. So, are you good enough for Christ? Love is patient. It is kind. And it keeps no record of wrongs. That's the be-all and end-all of Jesus Christ. He is love embodied, personified, eternal. And he looks for guilty people. And those that are not sick don't need a physician. So I don't know if that's a Christian who's writing that or if it's a non-Christian writing that. But if it's a Christian that's writing that, the most important prayer you ever pray is, God have mercy. God have mercy on my soul. Christ have mercy on me. And then it begins. That's the life in Christ. So you soon realize that, are you good enough? Well, that's not the question. Are you precious enough? And the answer is most definitely yes. And the cross says that. So, you know, I hope that's an honest question. I hope it wasn't like my question, which was just to provide a bit of gap from the silence. But, you know, I hope that's an honest question. And may God have mercy on all of us.
Thank you. Oh, that's a good point to end on. Give our panel a round of applause. Our musicians might just have 5 minutes to play us perhaps one or two songs. Please come back tomorrow. Pick up one of those with the details of tomorrow and on Thursday. Also details of what's happening on Sunday at the end of this week in our Meet Jesus series. Take one of those. And then Christianity Explored. This is a 6-week course. It's ideal if you've got questions about Christianity from scratch, or you just want to be refreshed in things that you've perhaps forgotten. And it is a chance to go through Mark's Gospel with others. Tanya, my wife, who's sat over there, and I will be leading it. And you won't be asked any difficult questions. You won't be asked to read the Bible out loud or sing. We promise to make sure there's nothing embarrassing you, but plenty of opportunities to ask any question that you want. But please take one of those tonight and do what Andy has said earlier on. Read it. And you might want to read it this evening or early tomorrow morning, and then come back tomorrow evening with some more questions, perhaps from this book that you've read over the next 24 hours or so. Thank you again for coming, and thank you again to our panel, to Andy, and thanks again to our musicians.